One Halloween party, my friend dressed up as me. At the clothing.
Did he wear your clothes?
Oh, yeah.
Did he, like...
He was a much prettier me than I could ever be.
Did he dye his hair? Did he have the right hair colour already?
No, he was wearing a bright orange wig.
Like a clown.
I dressed up as... Oh, there you go. I dressed up as Hunter last year. No, the year before.
The Jogcast is their life on ExoMars with Alex Clark, Luke Hart, Minnie Mao, Max Potter and Charlie Walker. The Jogcast, October 2016, Extra Edition. Hello everyone, welcome to the Jogcast. I'm Charlie and joining me in the studio today are Minnie.
Hello.
And Max.
Hello.
In the show this time, Max and Luke interview Professor Tetsuo Hatsuda about quarks and neutron stars, and Ian answers your astronomical questions. But first, before all of that, Charlie interviews Mitch Michalija in this month's Jodbyte.
For this month's Jodbyte, I'm joined by Mitch Michalija from JBCA. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you.
Is this your first time here?
It is, yes.
Could you tell us, to start off, a little bit about what you do, who you work with here at Jodrell Bank?
Yeah, so... It's a bit varied. So I'm officially an SKA engineer working on pulsar search with Ben Stappers, but I also work within the wider pulsar group, again with Ben Stappers, studying pulsars and fast radio bursts.
And all sorts of transient phenomena in the radio.
Yes, yes. All sorts, you know, fast radio bursts in general, but yes, on a wider scale, pretty much anything.
So as fast radio bursts are a more modern phenomenon compared to pulsars, which have been around for almost 50 years now, have you only just started working on them because they picked up off, or?
Well, so initially, when I applied to grad school, I was going to work with Duncan Lorimer, and pretty much around the time I applied, he had just found the Lorimer burst, which was the first FRB.
The most famous plot in the history of FRBs.
Yes. And also still the strongest FRB ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But, so I went, so that was at, when I applied was in the spring of 2007, and he had just found the signal, and then I started in August. So I started working on that, but then the field kind of died away a bit because there were, peritons were found soonish after that, maybe a year after they started to find peritons. And it started to cast a lot of doubt onto whether FRBs were real, plus no other FRBs were seen after that. I was looking for a host galaxy for it, but I couldn't find it, and people weren't very interested in wasting telescope time to look for one since there was, you know, growing doubt about the field. So we were trying to get money for a new project to look for FRBs, just use three unused telescopes at the Green Bank site to do just a dedicated some sort of drift scan survey pointed in three different directions. So you map out three strips of the sky and just look for FRBs. But that didn't get funded for a number of reasons. One, of course, being that, you know, the field was kind of dying away. Nobody was really interested. Everybody thought these things were fake. So I pretty much just stuck with normal pulsar research for a few years. And then all of a sudden, near the end of my PhD, a bunch were found and everybody was like, oh my God, they're real. Yeah, we need to study these. So it was good timing for coming here because I came here shortly after, those discoveries. I think, yeah, within a year of those discoveries here, I got the job here.
So we've had, a lot of lingo thrown out there. So very quickly, let's do a little bit of jargon busting. We've had Emily Petrov on in the past to talk about peritons.
Okay.
We've had other people to talk about FRBs as well. But I was wondering if you could give us a quick recap of what those two things are and why they're so synonymous with pulsar research itself.
Okay. So start with the FRB. So fast radio burst. It is a signal that comes from space. It's astronomical. The reason that pulsar astronomers found them is because they are dispersed because they are astronomical. So the signal is swept in frequency. So your lower frequencies arrive later. So when we're searching for pulsars, we are looking for signals of similar durations, right? Because we have to sample data very, very quickly to detect pulsars that are spinning with a few millisecond spin period. So if there is a fast radio burst that has a width of on the order of 5 milliseconds, say, and we're able to detect a 5 millisecond pulsar, well, then we should be able to detect a fast radio burst. And I mean, these fast radio bursts more or less look like a bright single pulse from a pulsar, except we only ever see one, except for the one repeating fast radio burst, but
we've only just been discovered.
Yeah. That's a bit of a puzzle.
We've got an interview coming up about that with Laura Spittler.
Oh, nice. So paratons, on the other hand, are terrestrial signals that look like fast radio bursts. So the name paratons in mythology is something like a half stag, half
horse,
something that has the shadow of a man. So more pretty much it's something that looks like something else. So these paratons were seen, and they were fairly obviously terrestrial interference, because so the system where fast radio bursts were first discovered was the Parkes multibeam.
So the Parkes radio telescope in Australia.
Yes. So it has a multibeam receiver, so it has 13 beams on the sky. And this Lorimer burst, the first fast radio burst found, was detected in 3 beams, so the beams don't overlap.
So it's looking at 3 different areas in the sky.
Three.
Or 13.
13 in total, yes. So three close by beams detected this event. So you kind of assume it came from somewhere between those 3 beams.
And was so strong that it spilled over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. The beams have a width, but they're sensitive outside of that width. The signal just happened to be strong enough where it was detected actually quite strongly in all 3 beams. These paratons, on the other hand, were pretty much detected in all of the beams.
Which would mean that they're even really, really strong.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much infeasibly strong or close. Right? Because if you have some astronomical source, it's going to be a point in the sky, because everything's far away, everything looks small. Whereas something that's close looks very large. So any interference, you're most likely going to see in all of the beams. So these paratons were seen in all of the beams. Interestingly, had the exact same, what we call DM, so dispersion measure. So this is this frequency-dependent sweep I mentioned. And that sweep was identical to this Lorimer burst sweep. So people thought maybe the Lorimer burst was one of these paratons, although the Lorimer burst wasn't seen in all 13 beams. This dispersion sweep is always very smooth if it's real, but there were some weird cusps, small, hard to see, but they were there in the paratons. So, I mean, most people weren't very optimistic about FRBs at that point, but there was still evidence that they were real, so Dunk very much, year after year, kept trying to get people to put money towards finding them.
And if there was so much doubt about them being real signals, why were some parts of the astronomical community so excited about finding them? What is it that makes them that interesting? That if there's one, and you don't quite know it's real, and there are lots of fake things that look the same, why do you keep hunting for them?
Pretty much because we have no clue what they are. So this is something we've never seen before. We have more theories for what they are than there are actual events. Right? So this is just new science. So, I mean, everybody wants to find new science. I mean, we all, day to day, study things that we know about. But, you know, everybody wants to find something new. Theorists always want to be proven wrong, and observers always want to look for something and find something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, with the SKA, at least, people are talking about it quite heavily now. You say you're going to do a whole bunch of things, and they're going to give you all these science results, and they're going to be amazing. But then 90% of the science that comes out of a survey with a telescope like that is stuff you didn't even know existed. It's the really exciting stuff, things we didn't know existed in the universe, or processes we didn't know that existed in the universe, or sources that we didn't know existed. So, I mean, people were very keen to find more. They just weren't willing to put any real effort in.
They were also keen to disprove paratons and sort of distinguish them from FRBs. So what happened at the end of that story?
Once more actual FRBs were detected here, people were fairly certain they were distinct from peritons, especially with this cuspiness in the dispersion sweep of the peritons. Maybe 2 years ago now, sometime recently, after studying these peritons for a while, they determined that they came from microwave ovens.
So in the lunch hall.
So one of the statistics they did was looking at the arrival times of the periton across the hours in a day, and they kind of correlate around noon. There's more peritons around noon, whereas if you plot the FRBs, they come whenever, because that makes sense, right? There's no reason that an FRB from space should know how fast the Earth rotates. And I think the peritons generally showed up stronger when they were pointing in the direction of the visitor center, and they found out that if the cooks in the visitor center were opening the microwaves before the microwave turned off, it would cause some sort of ring down in the magnetron that would emit a frequency swept signal, the sweep. So pretty much what you measure as the dm changes between models of microwave, but it's always around 300 to 400 or so, which was the dm of the Lorimer burst. I think the Lorimer burst DM was 375.
And this sounds really funny, really hilarious. The astronomers were detecting their lunch, and so they weren't finding any science there. But this is a common problem with radio astronomy in general, isn't it? The interference of things in everyday life that can sort of get in the way of radio astronomy. And you do a bit of work on that.
It is a problem because you want to be remote, but sometimes you can't, which is kind of the case with the Lovell. Of course, when they built it, it was fairly remote in the middle of Cheshire, but now Cheshire is a popular area. There's lots of people who live there now. So you get a lot more RFI than you used to. Plus, now everybody has cell phones. Those are, you know, back in the 50s, you didn't really have microwaves. Now everybody has microwaves, and they're convenient. So, I mean, there's a microwave at the observatory. It's in a Faraday cage, but, you know, there's leakage. So it's a trade-off between, well, we could make this observatory extraordinarily remote and give nobody any convenience, but nobody would want to work there. Mm-hmm. People want the convenience of getting to work easily, and they want the convenience of being able to heat their lunch up quickly.
I mean, there are signs all around Jodrell Bank saying that the Lovell telescope is powerful enough to pick up a mobile phone signal on Mars. So you can probably never get remote enough to...
No, certainly not.
Completely...
Yeah, there's not really anything you can do. I mean, especially since you can have people turn off their phones around the Lovell, but the Lovell isn't that far away from the road. It's not that far, especially not that far away from the train. And so if somebody has a mobile phone in their pocket driving by or on the train, the Lovell's going to see that. And then there's nothing you can do about that. It's just the fact that it's the time we live in. Everybody has mobile phones. Everybody has devices that are on and transmitting all the time.
What is the actual symptom of this sort of radio frequency interference, as well as creating possible signals which aren't real? Does it drown out signals which you want to see? And how do you work to mitigate it, even if you can't stop it completely?
Yeah, well, it's difficult. So it does definitely drown out signals. So your astronomical signal is very weak. And especially with pulsars, you normally have to add a bunch of data together to see your signal. I mean, yes, if there's some strong interference with a tiny signal buried in it, and then the tiny signal present elsewhere in clean data, and you add them all together, eventually maybe you can see your signal above that RFI. Or you can just ignore the data where there's RFI. But in the case of the Lovell, there tends to be quite a bit. So, I mean, if you start throwing out your data that's just affected by interference, have no data. So you do have to clean it, and it's difficult, but the nice thing is, especially with pulsars, we look at wide bandwidths. It helps us and it harms us. So the more bandwidth you look at, the more signal you get, so you're increasing your sensitivity. But also, the actual astronomically protected band is quite small. So if you look at a wide bandwidth, you're looking at bands where people are allowed to transmit. There are things that transmit on dedicated frequencies.
Like radios and stuff.
Radios, cell phones, satellites,
and there
radar.
Are dedicated safe zones where no one's allowed to transmit, and that's for astronomy, right?
Yes, so it's 1400 to 1428 megahertz, I believe, is the protected band. It is illegal to transmit in that band. Completely illegal to transmit knowingly in that band. Obviously, if you have some equipment that's malfunctioning, nobody's going to arrest you for that. I mean, you need to fix it. But if you were knowingly transmitting within the protected band, yes, that's illegal.
I mean, at the Green Bank Telescope, don't they have a guy who drives around with a detector?
Yeah, he has a van with a little dish on top, and he goes around and he attempts to pinpoint the location of these signals. So once he finds the general area, he gets out and he has a handheld dish that he then goes and walks around. And I mean, it's anything from a short in a heating pad that somebody had for their dog, to old refrigerators, motors in old refrigerators, to vibrating power lines. Because, I mean, sparks generate radio frequencies. Like a spark plug in a car engine will generate radio frequencies. Actually, the GPT, when it first started, took some data and has a great plot. It pointed towards the road. And the GPT is set very far back from the road for the reason I'm about to say. The spark plugs firing in a car that's driving by on the road, like very clearly in data from the GBT. So yeah, there was some power lines and there was some connection of some sort, and it was two things rubbing against each other, just vibrating, and it was generating a very small spark, and the GBT could see this as interference. It was miles away. So they had to get the power company to come out and fix it.
So obviously the GBT has the advantage of being incredibly remote and incredibly well policed in a way. Does it get a lot harder in an area like Cheshire with the Lovell telescope and a town very close by? Or are people more aware? Is the local council more accommodating to helping make the situation not get any worse? Or is it getting worse?
Well, certainly with the GBT, I mean, it's great because you're in the sanctioned radio quiet zone, right? Government sanctioned something like 13,000 square miles. I mean, it's enormous. So you can't put anything new in there, any new transmitters in there. I mean, it's radio quiet. It's quite nice. So people know ahead of time, if they move in there, they know what they're getting themselves into. They know they're not allowed to have microwaves. They know if they have a cell phone, it won't work. With Cheshire, there's no quiet zone. I mean, it's a smaller country. I mean, if you put 13,000 square miles around the Lovell, it would encompass Manchester. And you can't have a big city that's radio quiet. It just doesn't make any sense. Certainly, it's more of a problem. And yes, you know, there's around Lovell, there's Goosetree, which is, it's not a city like Manchester, but it's a town. You have a lot of people living there. I mean, there's sort of a town, air quotes, around Greenbeck, but it's tiny. There's so few people there, it doesn't make too much of a difference. And, you know, with Goosetree, we do notice more RFI in the direction of Goosetree, but it's not terrible. Since there's no sort of zone designated to keep any area around the level safe, it's open to increased interference over time. I mean, if any building happens, more people are moving in. I mean, I don't know if there's any restriction on building more, say, mobile phone towers, which would be terrible. If you put another town around the level, X people with X cell phones, the RFI is just going to get worse.
So you have to guard very carefully against future development if you can, but it's not always possible.
It is not always possible, right? Because, I mean, every place is getting more crowded, so you can't really stop development, but you can at least guide it so that it mitigates the RFI that's added.
And you can make people more aware. There was a funny example recently. Well, it wasn't very funny, but because the situation's hopefully been resolved, it's a little bit more funny, to do with a smartphone app, which at the time of recording this has only just come out, called Pokemon Go. So could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yes, so currently all the telescopes, the three telescopes on the site are down. So there's no, you can use your mobile phone on the site, but you shouldn't. So one of the people who work there downloaded the Pokemon Go app and walked around the site with the app on, and they found four Pokestops and a gym, and the gym was on the Lovell telescope.
And for anyone who's not familiar with what that actually means, it basically means that anyone playing this game will be very attracted to coming to the telescope with the app in order to play the game. And that would have been a disaster.
Yeah, it absolutely would have been. Right after this person found out, she contacted Nintendo and she told a bunch of people to try to get the Pokestops taken down and the gym removed. And since then they have at least I know the gym has been removed. I'm not entirely sure if the Pokestops have been. I assume they have. I assume if they took the gym down, they took the Pokestops away. But one of the problems is that I guess these sites were assigned based on popularity of places in a previous game called Ingress.
Mm.
So that means that for a long time, a lot of people have been walking around the level telescope with their phones on playing this game.
You don't necessarily know how many other games might do the same sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, obviously Ingress was using GPS data for location, which means that these mobile phones were transmitting quite heavily. You try to impress upon people when they're on the site how important it is to keep it quiet, but they don't always necessarily realize. They say, oh, I'll just take my phone. I know, you know, it's this one phone's not going to be a big issue. But of course it will. Obviously we could see that phone if it were on Mars. Plus, if one person has that thought, a lot of people are going to think, well, it's just my cell phone. It's not that big of a deal. And obviously a lot of people were doing this if these became sites in Pokemon Go.
Hmm.
I mean, especially if the level became a gym. People must have been standing right in front of this telescope, which is pretty much always observing even when people are around it. I mean, a lot of local people do understand, but of course visitors come from everywhere, so they're not all locals.
Hmm.
I know I've talked to people from Goose Tree before who are very aware of the RFI situation, then they do their best to keep it at a minimum.
But it must be hard to actually tell people where they live that you don't want them to use their phones in their microwaves. It must be, it's a balance, I guess, which is difficult in this situation.
Like I said, it's someplace like Green Bank, people know ahead of time. When they move into that area, they know that they're giving up cell phones and microwaves and things like that. And you end up with people who move in there who want that kind of lifestyle. They don't want to be bothered with a mobile phone. But in Cheshire you can't. And I mean, especially since it's such a posh area, you know, you get a lot of people wanting to move in. And you can't tell people, well, you're gonna have to live like it's, you know, 100 years ago.
So you're also an FKA engineer, you mentioned at the beginning. I guess the lesson we've learned there is to build it in the middle of a desert.
Yes, that is very, very smart. And there are a few of those on the planet, which is quite useful. So the two sites where this telescope is going to be built is in Western Australia and South Africa. So it's the, I don't know if the Western Australia desert has a name other than the outback. But the site in South Africa is the Karoo Desert. So those are both very remote, and there's very few people around them. I mean, at least with Western Australia, the population's very low, and with South Africa, there's no one really around the Karoo, and it's not as built up as, say, Australia. So there's less, you know, less mobile towers around.
Could you give us an overview of what you work on for the SKA as an SKA engineer?
Everything. Yeah, so I mean, well, engineer is sort of I guess it's the correct term, but it's, what I do is a bit broader than that. I mean, I am a scientist, but I have a lot of experience with hardware. So, what we need to do is to design a pulsar search that can work on the SKA within the requirements and within the monetary and the power budget. Our team's work is designing all the little pieces that make up a pulsar search, because there are quite a few steps involved, and we need to make sure that we can do all these steps in a set amount of time, and that we can fit all these steps on the hardware we've decided we can use given our power budget. So there are a few of the team members are doing coding for GPUs, a few are doing coding on FPGAs. What I do mostly is algorithm development. So how do we make a better algorithm to do something faster or use less power or fit on an FPGA specifically or fit on a GPU, because those pieces of hardware have different architecture.
And the FKA has not been built yet. and I'm guessing that not all of the hardware has even been ordered. So are you working based on sort of future specifications for what will be available when it finally gets built? Do you take that into account, things like Moore's Law and the power of computers going up over time? If the SK is not going to be built for another 10 years, let's say, the computers you're working on now will be really old compared to the ones that you'll be...
Yeah, absolutely. And we're completely relying on that fact, on Moore's Law, pretty much. We physically can't do what we need to do today. And so we've designed a system where... Our design is fairly mature, so for this stage, we don't have to build anything. We just have to come up with a design that we can prove meets the requirements. But we're doing a good job with our design. We're, you know, fairly far ahead of schedule. So we have an actual implementation that we're using to prototype, which it's a great way to get results, because you can run simulations on your bits and pieces and get results and prove you meet the requirements that way. But with our actual prototype, it's much better. But what we do is we get our numbers for our prototype, and then we say, okay, in 10 years, we've been talking to the people who make CPUs. We've been talking to the people who make GPUs. We've been talking to the people who make FPGAs. They've told us that that's going to be 4 times faster in the future, and we're 4 times slower currently. So in 10 years, we will meet the requirements. And I mean, that's all you can do. That's all you really need to do, because that's how these things work. I mean, there's always risk, and you mitigate that risk by, say, making prototypes. But yes, I mean, we're absolutely relying on these companies telling us the truth. You know, new technology that's just so much faster.
So in what ways are you able to test these prototypes out? Are there prototype telescopes that have been built that you're searching for pulsars with, or are you simulating pulsars and just searching for them? How are you doing your tests?
So up until now, we've been simulating data and running it through bits and pieces, whether those be on a CPU or a GPU or an FPGA. What we've just set up is our first actual prototype. So, I mean, we've had prototype hardware in the past, but we now have an entire prototype system, kind of an end-to-end system, because we were doing module tests before. Like, we'll test this piece, then we'll test this piece, then we'll test this piece. So our newest prototype is an entire pipeline, and we've just installed that on Meerkat.
Which is the...
That's this new telescope in South Africa, so it's in the Karoo. It's a precursor to the SKA? Pathfinder? Precursor?
Pathfinder, I think.
Pathfinder. I can never remember the distinction unless I think about it. So that's just actually had its first array release 2 days ago. But we had one of our team members go down there, and we shipped this machine down, and it's connected. It's not set up yet. So hopefully very soon we'll get that online. We'll be able to get actual pulsar data. I mean, simulated data works fairly well, but it's more testing the prototype in a streaming environment versus reading in a file.
So you'd be looking for new pulsars, or you'd be looking at old pulsars with this new telescope?
Yeah, so for this, we'll just be testing the prototype, so we'll just be looking at known pulsars. We'll probably start with a bright pulsar like Vela, which is insanely bright. Make sure we can detect it, make sure there's nothing wrong, that the detection looks fine, and then go to weaker and weaker known pulsars. But we're not going to be doing any science with this. It's just a prototype for purposes of proving we meet the requirements.
But one of SKA's goals will be to look for new pulsars.
Absolutely.
Would you be able to say why we want to find more? We've seen lots of them already. Why do we want to find as many pulsars as we can?
Oh, there's numerous reasons. So we know of about 2,500 pulsars. The SKA should find about 15 to 25,000, or bring the total up to that at least. So that's quite useful, because we'd like to know kind of what is out there. We need a broader population of pulsars. Maybe the ones we've seen are fairly local around us in the galaxy, and they only probe a certain corner of a parameter space. We need a galactic consensus of all the pulsars, and we really, really want to find a pulsar black hole binary. It's kind of the holy grail of pulsars right now.
It's an immediate Nobel Prize, isn't it?
Pretty much.
And why is it that people are interested in finding that?
I mean, that's the tests of gravity you could do with that system are immense. I mean, it's pulsars are the most extreme matter in the universe. Black holes are, you know, extreme objects. I wouldn't call them matter because we don't really know.
Understand.
Yeah, we don't even know if there's really matter inside of them. Maybe it collapses down to nothing. But, so you have two of the most extreme things in the universe in an extreme environment, tests that you can do nowhere else. I mean, you can't do them on Earth. Certainly, you destroy the Earth trying to do any sort of test like that. But it's not, you know, you couldn't even build anything like a neutron star.
So extremely high energy physics and tests of different gravitational wave detection.
Because, yeah, well, I mean, one of the things we need to do in just fundamental physics is find out how gravity fits with everything else. Because we can figure out how all the other forces fit together, and then there's gravity. You know, you have the electromagnetic force, the strong force, the weak force. We know how those go together, but we can't figure out how gravity fits in with them. So that would very much help figuring out how gravity works with all those other forces.
It's very exciting stuff. And you've been giving a few talks about your work recently. And you're giving a public lecture for the Manchester Astronomical Society at some point in the future. Is that right?
Yes. I gave a talk at this event called Pint of Science a few months ago now. It's a worldwide event held in a number of cities in different countries. I obviously gave a talk in Manchester on the SKA. And after that, I was contacted by somebody from the Manchester Astronomical Society asking me if I could give a talk for them in January, I believe. Sometime in early January.
2017.
Yes, 2017.
And that will be a public lecture?
Yes, it'll be a public lecture, an hour long, I believe it is. So the talk I gave for Pint of Science was 30 minutes. So this will be more of a lecture than a talk, so an hour long. I'll be talking about something SKA related. I know that I was asked to give this talk because of the Pint of Science talk, because when I was contacted about this upcoming Manchester Astronomical Society talk, they used language that I'd used in my abstract for the Pint of Science talk. So I know they either saw my abstract somewhere or somebody attended the my talk. And so yeah, I'll be talking about from my Pint of Science talk, the talk was more geared towards the challenges of trying to build the world's biggest telescope. So my Manchester Astronomical Society talk will be very similar, kind of the challenges involved and how we've overcome them.
Okay, and so we will maybe give you an interview about that, separate interview about that in the future. And when we find out more about the lecture, we will put it on the Jobcast website. So thank you very much, Seth.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thanks for that, Charlie. Now Max and Luke interview Professor Tetsuo Hatsuda about quarks and neutron stars.
Hello, I'm joined by Professor Tetsuo Hatsuda from the Riken Institute in Japan. It's one of the largest research institutes over there, and they do all sorts of interdisciplinary research from things like fish to graphene to quantum chromodynamics. We've just listened to a really interesting talk from quarks to neutron stars. So hello to Professor Tetsuo Hatsuda.
Hello, nice to see you.
And I'm joined by Luke, who's taken a lot of interest in this talk. And we've got some questions for you.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you wanted to start off and just tell us a little bit about your interest in quarks and neutron stars.
I mean, the quarks are the elementary particles, which are the basic building blocks of matter, and then our bodies are made of quarks. So how the quarks interact with each other, and then how our body is made of quarks is my interest. And then, of course, we can discuss that problem theoretically and also experimentally, but also in neutron stars, inside the neutron stars, I mean, the quarks get together and then form a exotic, very interesting state of matter. It may happen deep inside the neutron star. Therefore, that is also my interest. And then eventually that kind of thing could be studied from the observation in astrophysics. So that attracted me very much.
So could you possibly give the listeners a brief on the structure of the neutron star?
Okay.
And the interesting physics going on.
Yeah. So neutron star is a very interesting object that the radius is about 10 kilometers, but the mass is about the mass of the sun. So just imagine that if you compress the sun into the radius of the 10 kilometers, that is a neutron star. So it's a very dense object, but still it's very spherical. And then inside you have a liquid is called the neutron wicket. And then the outer side of the neutron star, it is solid. So you have a solid container, and inside you have a neutron wicket. And it's rotating very fast. Therefore, it's a very interesting astronomical object. There are so many neutron stars discovered inside our galaxy, so it's a very interesting object to be studied.
So a lot of your research, Professor, is centered around quantum chromodynamics, the study of strongly interacting particles.
Yes, yes.
So how does quantum chromodynamics link to the structure of a neutron star?
Yeah, so the quantum chromodynamics is the theory for quarks, and then as I told you that our body is made of quarks, but in the neutron stars, everything is compressed. Therefore, eventually, and the outer side is an ordinary matter, but inside you have a very compressed matter of quarks. And then you may have some new type of matter, which we don't see in the daily life. And that kind of exotic matter is very interesting to me to study.
So we know about that there are these interesting states of matter that happen inside neutron stars. Is there any way of measuring that observationally, or do you have to rely on theory?
Yeah. In astrophysics, what you can measure is, say, the mass, the weight of the neutron star, or the radius of the neutron star, or the outer magnetic field of the neutron star. All those kind of things can be, in principle, measured. And therefore, from these observations, you have to somehow try to understand the internal structure. That's a very difficult, thing to do, but still, by combining the observation and the calculation based on quantum chromodynamics, you may be able to eventually have some contact of the quarks with the internal structure of the neutron star. So that's the relation.
So you said that the neutron star, as a loose model, is composed of this liquid, and on the outside you have this solid.
Yes.
Is there anything interesting going on the inside, particularly with respect to the liquid of the neutron star?
So as far as liquid are concerned, if you have a liquid, neutron liquid, and then it's a quantum liquid, and then usually it becomes a superfluid. So it's not only just a liquid, but it's a quantum superfluid. And if you have a superfluid inside neutron star, and then normally the neutron star is rotating, in that case you have vortices inside the neutron stars, and that vortices have some interesting structure. They have a typically a micro size, 10 to the minus 13 or minus 12 centimeter size, but the number of vortices are very large inside the neutron stars, and then they may have some collective effect, like glitch of the neutron star, which is a phenomena that the spinning neutron star becomes suddenly spin up and then coming down. That kind of thing is measured in astrophysics, and that kind of thing is related to the internal structure and maybe related to this vortices dynamics.
So with respect to the interesting stuff that's happening inside the inner core, how close can we get to recreating those conditions in a laboratory?
That's a good question. And then actually there are lots of activities of having heavy ion collisions. And then especially the relatively low energy heavy ion collisions, you collide two heavy nuclei. And then in the intermediate state of the collision, you may have some compressed matter. And then that density becomes comparable to the density of the neutron star, internal state of the neutron star. Therefore, you may be able to see some experimental evidence of this compressed matter properties from this low energy heavy ion collisions. And then there are several laboratories trying to do this kind of experiment in the future, in Japan and also in Germany too.
You can start to begin to probe that regime in laboratories, but would you say that most of the information we have on these states of matter comes from astrophysical observations?
Yeah, so far, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what were the kind of turning moments in the history of understanding neutron stars?
A turning moment?
Any kind of big important discoveries that we've made over the years?
Okay. So one important discovery one would expect is the neutron star collision. And then we have already a black hole merger, and a gravitational wave emitted from the black hole merger. And then maybe in a few years, we may have a similar gravitational wave emission from the neutron star merger. And by detecting this signal, you may be able to extract the radius, and then eventually some density of the neutron star inside, and so on and so forth. So would be one of the most biggest event in this subject, I think, in a few years. I hope it will happen in a few years. And then people expect that this will happen in a few years.
So just to recap, we've gone through this neutron star and all the different physics, crazy physics going on inside, and superfluid neutrons, and the possibility of this exotic matter at the middle. Could you possibly explain to us what sort of physics and what's happening between the two regimes. So what's going on between the neutrons and this sort of exotic quark matter.
So there are several stages, and then one stage is that the first outer side you have solid of the nucleus, nuclear solid. And then, and because inside the neutron star, the pressure becomes larger and larger if you go inside. And then the, because of the large pressure, the matter starts to melt. And then eventually, a nuclear melt, and then it becomes the neutron liquid. And then if you have a larger pressure further inside the neutron star, then even the neutron start to melt into quarks. And then eventually at the center of the neutron star, you may have some quark matter, which is where quarks are floating around. Usually the quarks are confined inside the neutrons or protons, but deep inside the neutron star, quarks may be freed. That is called the deconfinement of quarks, and that may happen. And so there are several different stages from outer side to the inner side, and then those kind of things may happen.
One thing that you mentioned during the talk that I thought was quite a nice touching point that people might relate to is that there is some relationship between the physics that you're looking at inside these neutron stars and what the Nobel Prize that was won this year. Could you talk a bit about the crossover between those fields?
Okay, so Nobel Prize this year is originally from this, as far as I remember, 73 paper by Kostaritz and Saules, and then they have talked about the topological object called the so-called vortex. And then some matter may have some phase change from the one phase to the other phase because of the dynamics of the vortices. And this is called a topological phase transition. And then similar kind of vortices would appear, and probably it should appear inside the neutron stars, because neutron star, as I said, internal structure of the neutron star, you have a neutron liquid and it's superfluid. Therefore, you have lots of vortices. So inside the neutron star, there are lots of vortices exist. And then the interaction between vortices may also give you some sort of the phase change from one phase to the other. That kind of thing may happen. So that is the connection. And so topology is a key word which connects this year's Nobel Prize and neutron star vortices.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
One thing that I find quite interesting is that this thing that you're speaking about regarding the gravitational waves emitted from the black hole merger. Just for the benefit of the people who don't know, how much weaker or stronger would gravitational waves emitted from a neutron star collision be in comparison to a black hole?
So it depends on the mass of the object. And then the gravitational wave observed the last year from Advanced LIGO detector is that it's a rather heavy black hole, something like 30 times the solar mass. So because it was heavy, you have a large amplitude of the gravitational wave from the very far from Earth. And the neutron star mass is typically 1 to 2 solar mass. Mm. So the typically, if they are in the same distance, essentially the mass determines the amplitude of the gravitational wave. Therefore, you cannot have a very strong gravitational wave from the neutron star merger because neutron star mass is limited up to 2 something. But on the other hand, the neutron star merger has very interesting signal, because neutron star has a structure, so depending on the size of the neutron star, the gravitational wave pattern is different. Therefore, by measuring the gravitational wave pattern from neutron star merger, you may be able to extract or constrain the size of the neutron star. And eventually, that is related to the internal structure of the neutron star. So that kind of connection is very interesting in the case of the neutron star merger.
So what questions do you hope to answer when you get these observations? So firstly, I should ask, isn't a device like LIGO sensitive enough to pick up these events?
Yes.
And also, what will you hope to learn from?
Yeah, there are three detectors. One is Advanced LIGO, and then other is the Advanced VAGO, and then the third one is the Kagura in Japan. And then they will have some full operation in few years. And then if they start to measure this gravitational wave, then current estimate is that within few years, at least you can find one or two gravitational waves from neutron star merger. So they have a good sensitivity. So their estimate is correct, then they will be able to find some neutron star merger signal not far away from now. So,
okay, so that's something to look out for in the next few years?
Yes.
Do you think there's anything more interesting or weird or wacky that could be at the center of a neutron star?
So even more exotic.
Yeah.
The very exotic thing is this dark matter. If you have a lot of dark matter, and then this will be accumulated because of the large gravity of the neutron star. And then for a long time, if you accumulate all this dark matter inside the neutron star, then neutron star mass becomes heavier and heavier. And at some certain point, it goes over to the critical point and then goes to the black hole. So accumulation of the dark matter into the center of the neutron star may drive the transition from the neutron star to the black hole. That kind of thing has been discussed by several people. So that is, I think, one of the most exotic, interesting thing. Connection between dark matter and then neutron star.
So it's a far-reaching field then.
Yeah.
One thing I was going to ask about that you didn't really get time to talk about during the talk we saw was about hyperons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So inside a neutron star you have more exotic types of quark, right? Other than just the usual up-down types. So could you tell us a little bit about that, why that happens, and maybe why it's interesting?
Yeah. So if you go to the central part of the neutron star, then not only up and down quarks, but you have another quark called a strange quark, which may appear. Because if you have only up and down, then the kinetic energy of these up and down quarks becomes larger and larger as you increase the density of the system. Then it is easier or better to convert this U and D quark, up and down quarks, to strange quark. That makes this full kinetic energy smaller. Therefore, it's energetically favorable to have a strange quark instead of just having an up and down quark. But once you have strange quark, then total energy becomes smaller. Therefore, equation of state, which controls the state of the matter, becomes soft, and then neutron star can be easily compressed. And then the maximum mass of the neutron star becomes smaller than the twice the mass of the sun. That contradicts with the observation which we have now. Therefore, there is a puzzle. It's called a hyperon puzzle. Theoretically, it's better to have strange quark inside neutron star. But once you have strange quark inside neutron star, then it has some contradiction with the observation. Therefore, something is wrong. And then that is the open question, and it's one of the most interesting unsolved question in this community right now.
So you mentioned there the equation of state that was inside, and it becomes softer.
Yeah.
Right? So by that, we're talking about the kind of mass-radius relationship that you were talking about during the talk, where as you pile on more mass than neutrons are, you can reach a sort of critical radius. Could you explain a little bit about that?
If the equation of state is soft, then you can easily compress, and therefore typically the radius becomes smaller. On the other hand, if the equation of state is hard, then you cannot easily compress, the radius is typically large. And also, if the equation of state is soft, then if you put more mass, and then eventually it collapses into the black hole very fast. So the maximum mass of the neutron star becomes smaller for soft equation of state, and then larger for the stiff equation of state. So radius is smaller, and the maximum mass is smaller for soft equation of state. Radius is larger, maximum mass is larger for stiff equation of state.
Mm-hmm.
So there is such kind of difference. And then theoretically, we don't know yet whether equation of state is really soft or hard. But at least we have to explain two solar mass observation. And then you need to have some certain stiffness. Two soft equation of state can be ruled out by the observation already.
So one of the concepts that you've been through with us is the idea of these vortices perpetuating through the superfluid.
Yes.
Okay. Now, this might be a little bit harder to explain easily, but what happens to those vortices when they go into this proposed quark superfluid?
Yeah.
What sort of physics goes on there
if
we've got these objects, these vortices, going around in our superfluid, but then they must interact with the quarks as well.
That's right.
So what happens there? Can you explain this?
So if you have only neutrons superfluid, then you have, suppose you have single vortex, and then if it enters into the quark phase, theoretically the quark phase is also superfluid, which we can show. Therefore, the single vortex in neutron superfluid becomes three vortices in quark superfluid. So single vortex becomes split into the three vortices inside quark superfluid. So that kind of a strange structure, the bifurcation of a single vortex into the three, would happen at the interface between the neutron superfluid and quark superfluid. And that kind of thing may happen inside the neutron star too.
So the sort of, if I understand correctly, that's because if you've got a vortex in a collection of neutrons, when those neutrons are split into their constituent quarks,
yes.
the three quarks make
yes.
up the neutron,
yes.
right? So it effectively splits the vortex three
yes.
ways.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes,
okay.
that is a
yeah.
right picture. Yes.
So there must be some really interesting dynamics going on amongst those quarks.
Yeah, yeah.
There to be.
Yeah.
For every neutron going through that phase transition,
yeah.
there's three yes. different vortices coming out, that must be.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
I wouldn't want to simulate that.
It's going to get messy.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah.
So speaking of simulations, it was mentioned that your facility has some of
yeah.
the most advanced high-performance computing
yeah, yeah.
tech in the world. What kind of
yes.
simulations are you running there? And
uh-huh. So we have in RIKEN so-called a K computer, and K means the 10 petaflops in Japanese. So 10 petaflops machine in RIKEN. So we use that machine to calculate the nucleon-nucleon or nucleon-hyperon interactions by using so-called lattice QCT simulations. And then it is a very tough calculation, and then to really get one result, we spent almost 2 years. It's essentially the Monte Carlo integration, but you have so many degrees of freedom, therefore this kind of integration is very difficult, and then by using this supercomputer, we took 2 years to get some result, and then now we are still making some further calculation to increase statistics and so on and so forth.
And this is all related to that kind of quark confinement issue that we were talking about.
That's right, yeah,
yeah.
Quark confinement, and also how this confined quarks interaction between the protons and neutrons in terms of the quark degrees of freedom. So quarks are confined inside neutrons and protons, but the next question is how the neutrons and protons, which has quarks inside, interact with each other. That is another question, which is even more complicated question, and then that takes time.
But there's $1 million on the line if you get it right.
Well, yeah, but it's still a numerical calculation.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
I think mathematicians will not accept that it is a proof. It's not
okay.
a mathematical proof. It's
yeah.
plausible, I mean.
So just to fill the listeners in, this was part of the Clay Institute set of mathematical challenges where each one of them, I think there are seven.
Seven problems.
Yeah, and there's a bounty of $1 million available if you can provide a full worked mathematical solution.
Yes.
But I'm guessing they only want analytical solutions. Rather
analytical
than,
solutions,
right.
Not numerical, I think.
So Yang-Mills mass gap.
Yang-Mills mass gap is the...
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Go and get that if you want $1 million.
Yeah.
Get to work, listeners. And fill a postcard, please.
Yeah. It's a fancy way. Yang-Mills mass gap is a fancy way to say confinement of quarks. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just, if I can sort of get in my head, the scale. What is a petaflop? What is that?
Petaflop
is
so when you do calculations, you add or subtract all those kinds of the basic operations. One petaflop means 10 to the 15 operations per second.
Right. Okay.
That is a petaflop. So 10 petaflops means 10 to the 16 operations plus or minus or something like that per second. So it's very fast.
Wow. So doing that continuously for 2 years is an awful lot of
yeah, not continuously 2 years, but I mean because mm-hmm. there are other people using this computer
sure,
too,
yeah.
so we have to split, but still it took 2 years for us to.
So RIKEN seems like a really interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
What other kinds of work are you mm-hmm. doing over there?
I'm heading the Interdisciplinary Theoretical Science Research Group that contains physics, chemistry, and then biology, and then they are all theorists. So we are getting together once a week on Friday, and then all physicists, chemists, and the biologists, they're all theorists, but we have some lunch together, and then we discuss the recent problems and so on and so forth. And then during these discussions, sometimes biologists propose some interesting problem to physicists, and then physicists are interested in, and they started to solve this problem in a mathematical way or in some other way. So there are several already 5 or 6 collaborations started between physicists, chemists, and then biologists. And then I'm involved in one of them, and that is a fish retina program. And then in fish retina, there is a very nice pattern of the photoreceptor cells, especially this zebra fish, medaka fish. They have some very interesting, beautiful pattern. And how these patterns are formed has been unsolved problem since 19th century, because they knew it from 19th century, but they couldn't solve it. Why they have that kind of pattern? And then somehow we can map that problem to the statistical spin model, which is usually used in physics, and then eventually we could solve that problem recently. So that kind of discussion drives a very interesting problem solving.
Cool.
So
yeah, that's brilliant. What a great way of doing science.
Yeah, that's right.
Nice. So have you got any other interesting projects that you might be producing results from in the near future?
Oh, in this collaboration, interdisciplinary collaboration?
Or in any collaboration?
Just anything that's coming up from out of your office in the next coming months?
Oh, yeah. From the physics point of view, we would like to pursue further this calculation of this hyperon-nucleon interaction, or hyperon-hyperon interaction, which is very important for the neutron star structure, by using lattice QCD simulations. There is also a very interesting interaction between the condensed matter physicist and then particle and the nuclear physicist, because some common notion can explain both the particle physics problem and the condensed matter physics problem, and that kind of thing often happens, so we are going to that direction too. And then my own interest right now is still biophysics a problem, other than this QCD stuff, and then there are many interesting problems how the complex network in biology can be analyzed in a mathematical way that can be done together with the mathematical biologist, and that is very interesting.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Great. Professor Tetsuo Hatsuda, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's my great pleasure to be here.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Max and Luke.
And now we move on to the part of the show about things which we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends.
Well, yesterday was the day that ExoMars's little probe Schiaparelli was meant to land on Mars, and as far as I know, we haven't yet received a signal from it. I hope I'm saying Schiaparelli correctly. I think that's how they say it in the Martian movie.
Mm. Yeah, I seem to remember that's how it was pronounced.
I wouldn't know. I've not seen the Martian.
How have you not seen the Martian?
Charlie. Doing a PhD?
Have you read the book?
No. Oh, it's such a good book. I've got a long list of books to read, and it is on there. In fact, I think we've had this exact discussion on the Jobcast before.
So apparently the Martian is, you know that scene of Apollo 13 with the table and they're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole?
Mm.
So the whole of the Martian is like that one scene from Apollo 13.
You might notice that I'm being very quiet, and that's because I haven't seen Apollo 13 either.
Oh, sacrilege, this is outrageous.
I don't understand, we need to pause this show so Charlie can go watch a couple of movies.
Yeah, we're going
to
have a film night.
Well, I mean, Fiona, Jocelyn Fiona does film night.
Yeah.
So maybe we can get us put two of those on the list. Yeah, maybe one will win, and I'll have something to, I'll have one less regret in my life.
Well, I re-saw Apollo 13 recently, and it's such a great movie. But I'm very excited about any missions in space, and it's kind of sad that Schiaparelli hasn't yet, well, we haven't gotten a signal back from Schiaparelli, but as far as I understand, the ExoMars mission is relatively successful in that the trace gas orbiter, the TGO, has entered orbit around Mars. And if I understand correctly, the TGO is there specifically to try and detect signs of life. I think they're looking for methane, and you actually need to have something actively making methane, otherwise the UV rays from the sun will, and I suppose the universe, will actually break up all the methane molecules.
So this is the probe that's been put into orbit around Mars?
Yes.
And that is successful, and it's separately launched Schiaparelli, which is a lander?
I think Schiaparelli and the TGO were launched together, and then they separated, and one went into orbit, TGO went into orbit, Schiaparelli was supposed to land, and Max, you were telling us earlier, was the parachutes did deploy, but...
Yeah, I think the press release that they put out this morning, as of recording, was that the parachutes and the heat shields deployed correctly as it was falling, so they have got a signal as the lander was, entering the atmosphere. But the thrusters stopped engaging sooner than they should have, and they implied that the landing was not a soft landing as planned. So I love the way NASA are trying to spin it. It's like, it's really positive. You know, they got all this really useful engineering data about their spaceship crashing.
Sounds
and burning.
Sounds ominous. Yeah. I wouldn't like to have a unsoft landing on Mars.
No, unsoft landing anywhere. Have they said hard landing, or have they said...
They haven't. They've just implied that it was not a soft landing.
Because, I mean, even hard sounds like a bit of an understatement to me.
Yeah.
They crashed.
Yeah. Crash landing. Yeah. Catastrophic landing. But what were the base aims of the Schiaparelli?
So, I mean, to be fair, Schiaparelli's actual job was a test of whether we knew, or whether ESA and the Russian Space Agency... it's a test to see if they know how to land successfully on Mars. So essentially, as of yet, we don't know if that test has passed. As far as I know, Schiaparelli doesn't have solar panels or anything, so its power was only going to be from remaining battery power anyway.
So we can't think on the bright side in terms of Rosetta and the probe that landed on the comet, landing on the comet, losing sunlight and losing power, but eventually moving back into the sun, so it recharges itself.
Yeah,
it's just battery powered.
It's just battery powered. A thing I did think that was really cool about ExoMars is that it is, as I mentioned, a joint mission by the ESA, the European Space Agency, and the Russian Space Agency. And if the internet is correct, I got this information from the internet, initially ExoMars was funded by ESA and NASA, but NASA actually pulled out due to budgeting concerns. So the Russian Space Agency jumped in, so that was kind of neat.
That was really cool. Yeah, it's nice to see that sort of cooperation.
Yeah.
One thing that comes from cooperation, though, is like the sharing of knowledge. And
absolutely.
We've been landing things on Mars for quite a while now, Curiosity and that sort of thing. So
yeah.
Does anyone know why this has gone slightly wrong? We've landed stuff successfully there before. What's different about this?
Their answer is that they're decoding the information. So I think we're going to have to wait for the rest of the signal that was transmitted from Schiaparelli as it fell. Until they figured out what that's saying, we're not going to know what's gone wrong.
Yeah.
I think they were testing new technology, though.
Yeah.
It's like the parachute liquid propulsion braking system.
So it's a hybrid system.
Well, it's the braking system that seems to have failed, according to the press release. But that's me reading into their little implications. We don't actually know anything.
We don't know yet. And for listeners' benefit, this is time of recording is the 20th of October. And so that's one day after this.
Yeah.
So what will happen so this is a test for, I think, a 2020 mission. How does this impact the 2020 mission? Will they still go ahead, you reckon?
I imagine it'll still go ahead. There's always work to be done, and this kind of, when you have a lander that's so far away, you can't control remotely.
It took like 7 months or something to get there.
Yeah,
It's crazy. Imagine trying to be a person sitting for 7 months in a tiny capsule.
Well, that's the thing. That's an interesting point. I think that with all these unmanned missions to Mars, it's a really good idea. We've got to test all this technology. We can't send people everywhere. But it is something that we want to think about developing is the manned technology as well, right?
Would you go to Mars if you had the opportunity?
I wouldn't.
Yeah,
I would not go to Mars. I like the Earth.
But you've not been to Mars. It could be amazing. The culture would be completely new.
Yeah, it would be completely new. In more ways than one. Yeah. So I personally wouldn't go, but I do realise that it's probably quite important we develop this technology.
Right.
And one of the hard things about human spaceflight is obviously the protection. And that's something that you don't hear a lot about in the news at the moment. We are very focused on sending machines, aren't we?
That's true.
So.
Well, the Chinese just had their, I think, longest successful space flight to date. Qiankong 2, Heavenly Palace, China's sixth and longest piloted space flight to date. So I've only been peripherally following this, but I understand they've been successful, they've been in communication. So I thought that was kind of cool. And I think China's possibly one of the only countries right now that's actively sending people into space?
I mean, we've got Tim Peake.
Apart from
he's on Earth right now. He was in Manchester last Saturday.
Was he?
Yeah, he was giving a talk at the Museum of, it wasn't Science and Industry, the one on the train station.
If I'd known, I'd have tried to accost him for an interview.
That would be great.
but maybe you're right. It is good to see someone working on that side of things. Everyone's always working on that side of things, but it's nice to hear about that in the news.
Right. And China's been spending so much money on astronomy and space science recently.
Oh, yeah. Well, they've just they've just finished and inaugurated the largest single-dish radio telescope in the world called FAST. That was inaugurated, I guess, this month, October.
Right.
And it is a massive, massive telescope. So FAST stands for the 500-meter aperture spherical telescope. It's a massive fixed-dish telescope that's 500 meters in diameter. And actually, for reference, the second largest telescope is called the Arecibo telescope, and that's 300 meters in diameter. And our own Lovell telescope is only 76 meters.
To be fair, though, Lovell is fully steerable.
It is fully steerable, which is a
massive advantage. The third largest fully steerable dish in the world.
It is a massive advantage. So in order to see things with FAST, obviously, if you're not faced in the right part of the sky, you've got to wait for the Earth to rotate.
So will you be able to use FAST for your pulsar research, Charlie?
Me, myself? I'm not sure at all. I am very focused on using the Lovell along with the other telescopes in the UK, which make an array, an interferometric array called eMerlin. And so these are much smaller, but when you combine lots of radio telescopes together, you can do interferometry, which is basically you can look on smaller scales on the sky, and you can look for much weaker sources. And I know that you do that as well, Minnie.
My favorite soundbite about very long baseline interferometry is something like, if I stand in New York, I can read a newspaper that's in Los Angeles because my resolution is so insanely high.
That's I love those little analogies, like things that you're doing in science. It was like my favorite one about fusion was that if you had a swimming pool full of water and a laptop battery full of lithium, or the amount of lithium that's in a laptop battery, you could power all of Chicago for a year.
That's incredible.
That's so cool.
It's like a ridiculous statistic because you're having to assume so much about your reactor and everything, but it's a good fun thing to think about.
We were trying to make up lots of these analogies in the summer because some of the people here were working on what became known as AstroTram, I think, which was basically a science busking event that was done around Manchester where they commandeered trams and they had Brian Cox on the messages saying you were on the AstroTram and telling you facts. And people
so
with
cool.
boards and people with questions and all sorts of questions like this we were trying to come up with. So that was I think we mentioned it back at the time.
I'm glad I missed it.
But the only analogy that I ever hear around here is the analogy that a neutron star is about the size of Manchester. That's that's one of the things about working in the Pulsar group here.
Tetsuo brought that into his lecture on neutron stars.
Oh yeah, you hear it every time. But quickly back to FAST, we did say that it was a fixed dish. Actually, it can point.
Oh.
It has an active surface, which means that you can rearrange some of the surface of the dish, change it to a different shape, and point at different places on the sky.
They can change the shape of their 500-meter dish?
Yeah, well, each panel, so this thing has, this dish is made up of lots of individual panels, and these panels are attached to pulley systems, and these pulley systems can move, and they can adapt the surface of the dish.
That's
because
so cool.
Even though it's a 500-meter dish, not all of that is illuminated at all times. So you can change which bits are illuminated with the adaptive surface, and that basically means you can point it. And obviously it's not as good as being able to point the Lovell in any direction, but you've got a 500-meter dish. So.
I feel like there's a little bit of insecurity, like you feel like you're cheating on the Lovell. Charlie, it's okay, you can use other telescopes.
The lovely Lovell, yeah.
Right, so you were talking about interferometers. I think the last I followed on the BBC, the GMRT, the Giant Meter Wave Radio Telescope, was trying to observe Schiaparelli, and I think they got about a minute of data before it cut out.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty much all I had about sad Schiaparelli.
Did we actually talk about what Schiaparelli is meant to be doing on the surface? It's only meant to be active
for a few days, whether it lands.
Right. It's just a landing test. There are no things about taking...
Well, we're not going to get it back. It's going to...
sadly.
So basically the main thing is to test how to land, whether we know how to land successfully on Mars with these new technological advances. It does say that they'll do a little bit of work, but its scientific mission will only last a few days because it's based on the battery power. And the reason they're landing where they are, the Meridiani Planum, is a site of interest because there's likely rust or iron oxide, which implies there might be water.
Mm-hmm.
And at least on Earth, water equals life.
What was the name of that place again?
Meridiani Planum.
Okay. Good. I just want to plug Google Mars again, because I mentioned this on the Jodcast last time I was presenting. I just think it's such a cool website. So you can go to this and have a look at this landing site on Google Mars and find out all this information about things that are nearby and the features around it and actually see the surface of Mars where this lander has gone, just like you can on Google Maps. It's great.
I've got to say, even though this landing might have gone a little bit wrong, it's a really exciting time that we're living in, isn't it, with SpaceX and Google Mars and collaborations between all of the different astronomical communities. It's really cool.
Did you hear about the fact that I think Curiosity... every year, by himself or by itself, sits there and sings happy birthday to itself.
It's so sad.
Isn't it the saddest image?
I have heard that, yeah. I wonder
it's like a really sad MIDI version of it as well. It's like really like whiny. Oh.
I guess they planned ahead because happy birthday, then you just got into the public domain, hasn't it? But I guess maybe you're outside the constituency of...
That's an interesting copyright question. Yeah. If you play a song that's copyrighted, so nobody hears.
Mm. It's like if a tree falls in a forest.
There you go. Something about a bear.
Bears on Mars, yeah.
Who knows?
Poor curiosity.
Poor curiosity. Poor Schiaparelli.
Maybe we should have called it... Yeah. Melancholy.
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 Does anyone have any happy odds and ends?
Well, I've got one that's slightly happier. So I was looking up astronomy-themed Halloween costumes, because we're in the run-up to Halloween now. And as a fully grown man, I still like to participate in fancy dress from time to time.
You're going
to
avoid killer clowns, yeah?
Yeah, oh God, definitely. No, we're not even touching on that. I'm so sick of hearing about it now, you know?
Your hair would sort of work like a clown.
Outrageous, Charlie. I'll have none of it.
Should I take a photo and put it on
our... Yeah, I forget sometimes that we're on...
No, we can't have a... We've got the... So I was looking for astronomy-themed Halloween costumes, and I found that NASA does an annual Halloween costume competition. And I was going to complain about how terrible the quality of these are, because I thought it was NASA employees, but it turns out it's a public competition. No NASA employees are allowed to enter, so it makes sense that the quality that they're drawing from people who read NASA's blog is probably smaller than the 18,000 people that work for NASA. So I won't be too mean, but I think you could do better out there, guys. So you have a look at some of these costumes and send us some of your best. Like, if you've got kids and you've given them, you know, a little Curiosity Rover costume or something.
Or if you've dressed up yourself, you don't have to be...
Yeah, there. Or if you've dressed up yourself.
I've definitely seen a dog dressed up as the Curiosity Rover.
Oh, man, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really...
Singing happy birthday to himself.
I'd try it with my cat, but I don't think she'd be very pleased about that. Yeah.
Love to see a photo.
So if you've got any good ideas, there is the NASA competition. I think you can win like a swag bag from NASA if you have a really good one.
Is it open to UK listeners as well?
It didn't specify on the website, so I would imagine. But yeah, I just thought I'd mention that. Has anyone here got any good ideas for Halloween?
For a Halloween costume, strongly themed.
Ball of hot gas, like a star.
Hot gas, a ball of hot gas. How would you do that?
You know, that's a good question. Roll around in petrol and light myself on fire doesn't seem to be a good idea.
No, maybe not.
I'm just imagining dressing up as a radio telescope too, so I'm wearing a massive flea collar to use this.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Oh, that's really good.
We have made, I forget one time, whatever school I was at, people had little headbands and we made little dishes and then we stood together as an interferometer and did an interpretive dance.
That sounds amazing.
Because interferometry.
Max has talked about interpretive dance before.
Yeah, Philippa, my supervisor, Professor Philippa Browning, she was involved. She was a consultant, the science consultant for an interpretive dance troupe that were going into schools to teach people about the solar system.
Awesome.
So she was, I think it was, she was teaching them about flares, and they did some sort of like explosion from the surface of the sun.
Threw their arms out.
The solar winds up to Earth, and then the aurora and stuff. So yeah, they did the whole like sun Earth cycle.
They collapsed into black holes and ducked down to the fetal position.
I don't know if they went that deep.
I think we can plan something. On the topic of costumes, I know it's not yet Christmas, but the shop seems to think it is. One thing that does happen some years here is our very own Tim O'Brien dresses up as Father Christmas.
Ooh.
No, I didn't see this last year. I've heard.
I didn't see it last year either, but I hope I do. I really hope I do. He's got the beard for it. He needs to dye it white.
We can just stress him out a little. Mm.
But we will. I'm sure we could. We'll need to get a picture of that and put that on the website when that happens. So yeah, if anyone has any ideas about costumes.
But we could dress up as like effects. You could do diffraction patterns. You could do refraction patterns.
Nice.
You could go with an array of telescopes. Oh, I can think of so many astro-themed things.
Oh, you've given them so many ideas. So if anyone manages to execute any of these, let us know about it. No matter how terrible, I want to see it.
Or how great. I want to see someone dressed up as a black hole.
No, that would be something, wouldn't it?
That would be so cool.
You'd only see the event horizon. Anyway, talking about black holes, supermassive black holes, in fact, this is quite a convoluted thing, but my event involves the Jodcast itself. Some of the people from the Jodcast were actually interviewed, rather than doing the interviewing. Myself, Ben Shaw, George Bendo, and Adam Averson were all called up to be interviewed for a new up-and-coming student radio station on Fuse FM called Rocket Science.
Oh, that's punny.
That is. It's called rocket science because it blends talk about science with rock music. And so they talked to us about the Jodcast. They asked us why we did it. We actually spilled some secrets that we've never talked about here. Sometimes when the website goes down and we don't actually specify why, you might be able to hear about that if you go and listen to the interview. So yeah, there's some
juicy inside scoop.
Yeah. So it was broadcast, or it will be broadcast on the 21st of October 2016 at 1:30 PM, which will be too late by the time this episode goes out. But they hope to have a backlog of podcasts online. So hopefully you'll be able to listen to us there, and we'll link you to it in the show notes if you can. And if you're interested in listening to this radio station, it sounds really cool. They have a Twitter account, which is @rock_itscience. And so, yeah, one of the things that we talked about was astronomy-related songs. And Adam then went on to send these guys a list of songs that he thought of. There's lots of David Bowie on there.
I love astronomy-related songs. My favorite one is Do You Know the They Might Be Giants song? I think it's like The Sun is a Massive Incandescent Gas.
No.
Oh, it's such a great song. When I was in, I think, second year astro, we had a pop quiz. And this is my favorite pop quiz of all time because it was just multiple choice. And Professor Prentice, Andrew Prentice, gave us this pop quiz. And question one was something like, the sun is A, a massive incandescent gas, B, a gas of indeterminate mass, C, so on and so forth. It was so great. I passed that pop quiz, so special place in my heart for that
one.
Oh,
that's good. Yeah, They Might Be Giants had a few, didn't they? Why Does the Sun Shine? Is that another one?
Was that one? I don't know that one. The only other astro song that I really like is the Monty Python one, the Galaxy song. But it bothers me because all the units are in miles. So, you know, obviously being Australian, we use kilometres. Don't understand the country.
There are loads, though. There are going down the list that Adam linked to. I mean, we all like David Bowie here. Life on Mars, I guess we're not going to find that out with ExoMars anyway.
So sad. The TTO might.
There's Muse, Supermassive Black Hole. There's Neutron Star Collision, which is a song referenced by Tetsuo Hatsuda in his talk.
So they, Muse wrote a song for the Twilight film called Neutron Star Collision. And Tetsuo played this in his talk, because he states that they predicted the Neutron Star Collision before it's been recorded. It's still yet to be recorded. We're waiting for more gravitational wave data.
So maybe a Nobel Prize for Muse.
Yeah, no,
it wouldn't be for literature.
No,
What else was there? Well, there's even heavy metal on there, to be honest. There's Metallica have a song called Orion, and I think the Misfits are heavy metal as well. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they've got a song called Teenagers from Mars.
So I checked this, and apparently, according to their Wikipedia page, the Misfits are horror punk, which is a terrifying genre.
Well, that's good for Halloween. Yeah. It's quite an appropriate episode. It's all wrapping well and very nicely. But if any of the listeners have any ideas for astronomy-related songs, tweet us or email us with them. And definitely check out the show Rocket Science as well. They're a cool bunch of people. It was a really, really fantastic
It's interview. A cool idea, because you don't get many talk radio stations that have a like specific subject and a music thing going. And I think there's a strong cross-section of astronomers who like rock music, right? So it's a good...
We did tell them to play the Jodcast theme tune on there, but I don't know if that will ever happen.
Oh, we'll have to get like a heavy metal version of it recorded.
Oh.
Now, to hear about heavy metals of a different sort, Ian answers your astronomical questions in this month's Ask an Astronomer.
Hello and welcome to Ask an Astronomer. I'm Alex Clark and I'm here with Ian McDonald, who's going to answer your questions. First question is from Yoda the Oak. I'm trying to get my head around the production of metals from a star to the ring on my finger. If stars, when exploding, produce metals and other complex elements, do we know how much metal a star could make just from its light emitted? Is there a process from exploding star to planets?
Well, the story of how you get metals from the heart of a star to the ring on your finger is a complicated one. It's actually the very story I'm trying to piece together at Jodrell Bank. See, most jewellery is made up of the transition metals in the periodic table, which astronomers consider to be heavy elements. These elements are heavier than iron, and there's two kinds of star in which these are made. About half the heavy elements get produced when a massive star undergoes a supernova explosion at the end of its life. These are known as the R-process isotopes, and the other half made during the final phase of the life of slightly smaller stars, like the Sun, or a few times the mass of the Sun, and they're referred to as the S-process isotopes. Now, depending on which element your ring is made out of, it may have come from either kind of star. For example, iron, gold, silver, and platinum are typically formed in supernovae, while copper and the various silicate mixtures that you find in gemstones come mostly from lower mass stars, and some elements, like the carbon and diamonds, come from both kinds of star. But wherever it comes from, it has to get out of the star. And in the case of smaller stars, the star slowly shakes itself apart during the asymptotic giant branch phase, spreading dusty seeds throughout the galaxy, a bit like a giant puffball, before becoming a planetary nebula. In the case of larger stars, which have to be at least 8 times larger than the Sun, the star runs out of fuel, collapses under its own gravity, and then violently explodes, hurling its innards out into space in a supernova explosion. Now we can work out what the star's created by taking a spectrum of the material it's thrown off. For smaller stars, we can do this while the star's still alive, by looking at the elements and molecules which condense in the wind that flows out from the star. But in either case, we can do a post-mortem of the star, and look at the planetary nebula or supernova remnant that it's left behind. The spectrum of each of these remnants is composed of a series of lines or bands, and the wavelength of light that these are found at correspond to a particular element or molecule. And the strength of these lines tells us how much of each element there is. But this doesn't tell us about every element. Some elements don't have strong lines at wavelengths that we can easily access from Earth. Gold, silver, and platinum are among these because they're so rare, and as a result of that, they're rarely measured in stars. For these elements, we have to use models. And these models are based on a combination of nuclear theory and theories of stellar structure. They model the entire life of the star, and they work out where the elements are produced, and when, and how they are released. And if these models can be tuned to match the abundance of the elements that we see, and the abundance of the elements in the solar system, then we can work out how much there is of the ones that we can't see. Once these newly produced elements leave the star, they're spread across the host galaxy. Some work their way into dense clouds of matter that collapse and form stars, and some of those atoms may end up in planets around that star. Some of those atoms may end up on the surface of planets with life, which is either intelligent or stupid enough to go around digging it up, and some of those atoms might be forged into a ring to go on a finger. But it's perhaps a little curious that a ring, which is often the symbol of the permanence of a union between two people, should be forged in the death of something as apparently constant as a star.
Very interesting. That's a great answer there. So the next question comes from Philippe Lariche, and they say, please can you explain why cosmologists and GR gurus get so upset about information being lost as stuff falls into a black hole? Why can't they just treat it like spilt milk? It's gone. Get over it.
Well, if only it were that easy. Information's a bit like energy. Quantum mechanics dictates that it can't be entirely copied, and it can't be entirely destroyed. It can be sort of copied through quantum entanglement, and it can be garbled up so much that it can be all but destroyed. But if you're omniscient, and could deconstruct everything into its purest waveform, you should still be able to rewind the universe and see what was originally there. So if you have a piece of paper, and shred it, it's still technically possible to put the pieces back together and retrieve the information on it. Even if you burn the paper, collect all the ashes, bury it in a shallow grave and never speak of it again, you could still technically retrieve the information if you knew the exact quantum mechanical details of all the intervening processes. So it is with all information, including the information describing the particles that falling into the black hole. Now, if information falls into a black hole, that's fine. It's stored in the black hole and it doesn't go anywhere. Except that there's a problem. That problem is Hawking radiation. Now, if you've never heard of Hawking radiation, it might be a little bit difficult to get your head around unless you take the time to understand it. But we'll have a go here anyway. First, you have to accept that pairs of particles spontaneously appear out of the vacuum of space, and then spontaneously annihilate each other across all of space and all of time. Now, it's weird, but it's true. We've shown this happens, and we can demonstrate it happens using the Casimir effect. Then you have to imagine that a pair of these particles spontaneously pops into existence on the event horizon of the black hole. And before they can annihilate each other, one gets sucked into the black hole, while the other escapes. Now, the escaping particle's borrowed energy from the vacuum of space around the black hole, and it needs to give it back somehow. And it does that by taking a little bit of energy from the black hole, and by E equals mc squared, that takes away a little bit of the black hole's mass. So the black hole gradually shrinks one particle at a time. And here's the problem. Eventually the black hole will disappear. It'll evaporate. But what's happened to the information that fell into it? Has it gone? Well, no one really knows. It may be relativistically stored on the horizon of the black hole and escape with the Hawking radiation, but problems occur once a certain fraction of that information is leaked out. Either way, there's a problem. If the information disappears, that means that quantum mechanics is incomplete. If it doesn't disappear, that means that general relativity is incomplete. So solving the problem has major implications for fundamental physics. And you might think this is all very esoteric and doesn't matter, but if general relativity itself wasn't discovered a century ago, modern GPS navigation would be an impossibility. And who knows what our great-grandchildren might be missing out on if we don't understand this next key piece of physics.
Okay, so the next and final question comes from Paul Stevenson, Given the confirmation from NASA of liquid water on Mars, is it time to revisit the results of the Viking lander test back in 1976? I understand the mass spectrometer used to confirm the findings was much less sensitive than the experiment intended to test for microbial life.
Well, the question of whether there's life on Mars has excited both scientists and the public alike since Schiaparelli first noticed his channels on the Red Planet back in 1877. It's a key question that has major implications. If life arose on two different planets in the same solar system, it astronomically increases the chances that life is present elsewhere in the universe. I've even got a textbook from the 1960s that unequivocally states that there is life on Mars and soliloquizes about its inhabitants. But by the time we flew past Mars in 1965, it was abundantly clear that the little green men just weren't there. The main problem is that the Martian atmosphere just isn't thick enough. It's been just that little bit less dense that needs to sustain liquid water. Water can only exist on the Martian surface as either solid ice or steam, and without liquid water there can be no life, at least life we would recognize. Worse still, without a protective magnetosphere, Mars's surface is subject to much harder radiation than we would find on Earth. So even though the mass spectrometer and other instruments aboard Viking weren't that great, there's probably still little point looking for life in that data, or in any other surface mission. So there's no life on Mars, but there is still a faint glimmer of hope that there might be life in Mars. Beneath the surface, pressures are higher, and aquifers might exist. It's still not entirely proven whether the streaks seen in some craters are evidence that thermal springs are working their way to the surface. It's a strong possibility, and we won't know for certain until we go there and sample one. Their existence suggests there is still some notable hydrological or hydrothermal activity on Mars, despite the lack of surface water and plate tectonics. And these deposits may be able to tell us if there's life on Mars now. So one possibility is to go there, to these hydrologically active sites, and dig down under the surface to see what's there. But most scientists aren't hopeful, and the ones controlling the budget would rather look for the fossilized signatures of ancient life, from back in the most ancient times of Mars when it still had surface water, and to understand why Earth thrived while Mars desiccated. That information is more likely to exist. It could still answer the same questions, but broadening our understanding of the evolution of planets.
Thanks for that, Ian and Alex.
And now on to the feedback. We've had no posts, but we have had some emails. There's an email from Greg Bernstein who says, I went to iTunes to review the Jodcast. I discovered it's been 8 years since I last reviewed it. Please keep up the good work. Gee, I could just bark in all of this, you know, lovely praise.
Really nice email.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah, Greg also says that the in-depth interviews are extremely interesting. He lives in an area with light pollution, so can't really take advantage of the information about the night sky. Hey, Greg, drive out into the country.
Yeah. We know that feeling in Manchester.
Oh, right? Yeah. But I do like this. However, giggling, bracket, Fiona, close bracket, or close parentheses rather, and other mirth on the show is welcome. Keep up the excellent work. Well, thanks for that, Greg.
Yeah, that's a great email. Long-time listener as well, 8 years since you last reviewed it.
We've had a few tweets as well. One was from Adam Averson of the Jodcast, who asked whether the new picture for the Jodcast episode October 2016 was revenge for the show being out so late. So firstly, I want to say I am very sorry that the show was out so late. It came out about the same time as the extra probably should have gone out. And that, for a variety of reasons, we have had a few days, as Adam mentioned in the September extra episode, where we've been fixing lots of the old code that the Jodcast runs on. We've been doing things to the machine. And it took a lot of time, but it's going to be very useful in the future and hopefully make us more efficient in the future as well. That was one of the reasons that things were delayed, because stuff that we did went wrong with that, and so it took us a lot of time to debug and fix that. We did have a few issues with certain parts of the Jodcast episode coming out a little bit later than planned as well. Maybe that picture was a reference to that. I don't know. The person in the picture seem to think it quite funny anyway.
I thought it was quite appropriate for the Halloween, you know.
I think a certain somebody sent an email saying that the face was quite off-putting, which Matt found very, very sad.
Aww.
Poor man.
Tell Matt he's beautiful.
If you liked that picture, let us know. Yeah.
If you didn't,
also let us know, actually. but try and make it not personal.
Yeah, nothing about the face in particular.
Don't tell us why you didn't like it, if it's about the face itself. If you just think it's not appropriate for the Jodcast, then that's fair enough. We won't be doing that every week.
So we got another one from Daniel Carazone. Just listening to the discussion of comments from the survey. Heartily endorse hashtag Jodon. Love that hashtag.
Thank you, Daniel.
You should also check out Flickr to see some of the new images our listeners have posted.
And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website, www.jodcast.net.
Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us posts. The address is on the website. So for this episode, thanks to Professor Tetsuo Hatsuda and Mitch Michelijah for the interviews. The editors were Charlie Walker, George Bendo, Luke Hart, and Monique Henson. And the producer was Benjamin Shaw. Until next time,
Jodon!